Whenever you rent or buy a video, you need to be sure that the film you choose is suitable for the audience at home. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
Welcome to Friday Night Movie Time Podcast, episode 16, I think we are now. This is Mike.
This is Lee.
And this time we are discussing 1984's Beverly Hills Cop. Gonna say it off the bat, one of my favourite ever films. Yeah, and Pete speaking in there with part of the soundtrack. That is Axel F. by Harold Faltermeyer.
When did you first see this film? Was this a video release? Was this a TV release?
Christmas 1987, BBC One, the edited version. I think it was on around about 9 o'clock that night. The big premiere that afternoon was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So we definitely had both of those recorded off the TV. So I must have had a couple of blank tapes that Christmas.
Ooh, a blank tape with your name on it as well.
Yeah, not like a mum's tape as well, Peter Kay used to joke about.
I remember seeing this rental for me first time. I'd loved Eddie Murphy ever since I'd seen him in 48 Hours. I was probably a little bit too young to rent them out, but I think I've mentioned on the show before, they didn't give a shit what I rented out. The people in the video shop, as long as they didn't rent porn.
That's true, mate. I don't know where we could find it, really. I suppose too high up for us little kids.
Where I live, they had three video shops in quite short distance together, and One of them had an adult section. Do you remember the old beaded curtains?
I was going to say, were there like glittery curtains at the back or there just beaded ones?
Beaded ones, which you weren't allowed to go past unless you were an adult. And I was like, I don't really care about that. I just want to see all every other film you've got.
When you like appeared back out of there, was like the, like a twinkly pantomime sound, you know, just to show you'd been in there.
It was like this dodgy guy, bald hair and pubes and really bad glasses.
Sorry, go back. You saw his pubes. What?
No, he had hair like pubes. You know, one of those people that are going bald but don't admit it? One of them.
Fascinating history production of this film, the pre-production. It's put down in the making of on the Blu-ray that Michael Eisner, the head of Disney, had this idea. As he lived in Beverly Hills himself, and there was a break-in in his house sometime in the 80s, and the cops in Beverly Hills were at his house inside 2 minutes. Executive producer Don Simpson, who made this movie along with Jerry Bruckheimer, he was driving an old car through Beverly Hills at one point, in a moment reminiscent of a scene we see when Eddie's character Axel first arrives, and he was pulled over by the cops in Beverly Hills for having such a basically piece-of-shit automobile. In a very posh area.
When I was doing some research for this episode, I mean, this was released in 1984. So at the time, Eddie Murphy was still one of the regular cast of Saturday Night Live. So my first thought was, this film is just a vehicle to make him a star. He'd already starred in 48 Hours. I was a little bit apprehensive going back because I'd loved this film so much as a kid. And I thought, is it going to hold up? It's very dated in the sense of it's a very 80s movie, but in the best possible way.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. Of its time, but as you said, but also got a great fondness for this movie, basically. That's what I'll say. I don't think I'll ever really dislike it.
I'd have to agree with you there. I mean, there are a lot of tropes in this movie which go on and get parodied quite a bit, especially with the angry police chief.
Yeah, and can I say my story, that my father has actually met that man?
Please tell us that story.
Long story, my father managed to work his way up in the special police, special constables we have in the UK, who are the reserve police force. And they had a bit of an exchange going with police in Michigan, of which, of course, Detroit is based, back in the 1990s. And he went over on a trip around about 1997. And there was various sorts of ceremonies going on where, you know, they did that almost Masonic thing of like swapping the old Bobby's helmet from the UK for one of the truncheons of the American police. And one of the local councillors there, my dad's actually got a video with him, went by the name of Gil Hill, who was a Detroit councillor for many years in the 80s and was actually asked to appear as Eddie Murphy's boss in this movie. So in a bizarre sequence of events back in 97, my father came back from that trip and told me, yeah, I met someone who played Eddie Murphy's police chief in Beverly Hills Cop. And I thought he was pulling my leg. He was lying. You know, why would that be the case? Why would a guy be who was acting in a movie like this? You know, why would he actually be on the city council or a councillor?
Yeah.
But then I saw a video was taken of the events a few months later. And so got it on there. My dad chatting to old Eddie's boss. So
that's very cool indeed.
Both gone now. Go rest them in peace.
I can completely get where you're coming from. If a member of my family had said, oh, yeah, I was talking to someone that was Eddie Murphy's boss, you're thinking, yeah, that's rubbish. But it seems to be quite a common thing to take people from that background and actually put them into the films, into those parts.
Yeah, at the time, you know, when you go back to how certain, you know, we're both fans of sort of Doctor Who and sort of the old classic British cinema, and you found out how people like John Pertwee and Patrick Troughton, for an instance, two of the earlier Doctors, how they got into roles through, you know, they were in the Navy, first of all, and they just almost chanced upon it, an acting career.
I can't think what his name is. I know he's been in films for Oliver Stone. He was also in Band of Brothers, who plays, you know, like a military general. And then when I actually looked into it, he had actually been a US general. So it was like, wow, that's amazing. You'd never think of anyone going that high up in that field of work to then transfer into an acting career.
People who don't have much acting experience. As you said, this was Eddie Murphy's first main starring vehicle after the hits 48 Hours, a great Walter Hill movie. I was debating whether to do that one for this episode instead, but I wanted to show his first real star vehicle. And then he ended up in John Landis's Trading Places, which was another huge hit in 83. And then this year he did Beverly Hills Cop. And can you name the other movie he had a small role in this year, Lee?
Best Defense?
Yeah, that's the one, the famous tank scene. Don't think I've ever gone back and watched.
I went maybe about 10, 15 years ago, I went back and watched it and just thought, this film is advertised off the back of Eddie Murphy being in it, and he's hardly in it. In the same way, have you ever seen the Woody Allen film Bananas?
Yes.
Where in many places it's advertised as starring Woody Allen and Sylvester Stallone, where Sylvester Stallone's in it for about 30 seconds.
Isn't that before Rocky? So
long before Rocky.
Yeah, about 71, and Rocky's 75, 74.
And it might even be before his Italian Stallion movie.
That's one for another podcast, I think.
That's Friday Night Movie Time Nights.
Like Baywatch Nights back in the day.
Yeah.
Talk about the casting process on this. Approach for the role, first of all, it was more of a serious movie than having a comedic element. We had Al Pacino, James Caan, and Mickey Rourke was in line to play this role, but it got delayed so often that he was given another movie. Apparently, it then went in the direction of Sylvester Stallone, which would have been an entirely different project. You know, it may have been a good enough movie to watch, but I don't think it would have stood up this well.
I just don't see Sylvester Stallone as Axel Foley.
No, I think he was going to be called Gabriel Coberetti, which gives you a clue as to what direction some of the elements from that script took into another movie 2 years later.
Would it be Cobra by any chance?
I think it might be. Very gracefully, they mention in the behind-the-scenes documentaries, Sylvester Stallone stepped aside. The supporting cast, people like Judge Reinhold, Stephen Burkoff, John Ashton, they were expecting Sly to arrive, but overnight, Eddie Murphy quickly came in and bonded very well with the set.
As I said before we started recording, this film, as well as the soundtrack, is just littered with 80s stapled actors. You know, people like Michael Campion, Paul Reisner. I wouldn't say Bronson Pinchot, because was this his first movie?
Kind of breakout. He had the sitcom was when he played the Eastern European guy a few years later, and that was more of a breakout for him, really.
Yeah, but this was his first movie role.
Yeah. That's a very, very memorable scene.
The guy that appears in Breaking Bad.
Jonathan Banks. Actually, that is one scene that disturbs me. When Eddie Murphy's friend gets killed and he actually holds the back of his head and pushes the gun against his skull and fires. I think that was always cut out in the BBC version. I have to look away at that scene nowadays. That's the only part of the film that genuinely I can't watch.
I found him more intimidating as he got older, especially in Breaking Bad with the bald head and the goatee.
Better Call Saul as well. He's in the prequel, Better Call Saul.
I think as a child, I probably would have found the holding his head and shooting him disturbing. As an adult...
there's no blood or anything, but it's just the action.
But as a middle-aged man, my first thought was, you couldn't hit him from that distance.
There'd be a lot of shrapnel, wouldn't there? Head, yeah. President Kennedy-style shrapnel. I don't think
maybe that was done just to save money. I mean, if you had just shot him in the bullet, the blood squirt out. Because was this an R-rated movie when it came out? It was only a 15 in the UK.
I think it was possibly an R, or maybe one of the first PG-13s. But I think it was a budgetary issue, I think. The scene we mentioned, the brutality of that killing. Jonathan Banks, and this is a point where I used to get slightly confused, because Jonathan Banks appears as one of the policemen at the start of 48 Hours with a shootout in the hotel. So that was sort of confused me, the scenes that... And there's this and the strip club scene later on, which the director openly admits was based on the strip club scene in 48 Hours. So they all sort of blend together for me from my childhood.
Yeah.
I obviously thought a lot about strippers in my young childhood. So.
Yeah, of course you did. And still now you think about them.
I do, but yeah. No closer to them either, this age.
This is very much a staple of the 80s, where things like you had strip clubs. There was always Terminator, there's a scene in a club. Police Academy. The Blue Oyster Bar, these tropes of like, let's put it in the nightclub, let's put it here, let's put it there. But this film just is so wonderful in the way that it has been dated.
And the pacing as well, you know, I think it's about 1 hour 50, but it never lets up. There's always something interesting to see in each scene.
Oh, yes. I was never bored rewatching this again. I don't know about you, especially now that mobile phones come along. If there's a boring part in a film that I've already seen, I will pick my phone up and start looking at probably Facebook. But with this, I just didn't bother. I was engrossed in it in every scene.
Yeah, the major part of that, I think, is Eddie's energy and charisma in every single scene. You know, a lot of the cast mentioned that in the behind-the-scenes footage as well. This was very much improvised. Ronnie Cox plays Detective Bogomil and also appeared in Robocop. Eddie Murphy would often improvise, but he'd always lead him back to a point where he cued in the next line by improvising. But he'd always cue Ronnie Cox back into the correct line to hit his mark.
Because Ronnie Cox, wasn't he a bad guy in Robocop, if memory serves?
Yeah, he's Dick Jones.
Yeah, that's it. I couldn't remember the character's name. I always struggle to see him as a bad guy, even though he plays a bad guy very well. But he also plays a good guy so much better.
They got the hook in the sequel to this, haven't they, of him getting gunned down at the beginning?
Even though the sequel isn't as good as this, that is the one bit that always got me when they gun him down. It's like, no, please don't let him be dead.
Yeah, and I really like the sequel. It's not half as good as this, but it's very watchable. It's just more of Eddie. But then I've only ever seen part three once, and I have no intention to see it again.
Same here. I've seen the third one once, maybe twice. The only interesting bit about that is George Lucas turning up. I used to like the sequel more than the original when I was a kid, only because by the time the sequel came out, my hormones had started to really kick in. And the scene where you see Bridget Nielsen's in that very short skirt was one of my favourite scenes.
It wasn't a Beverly Hills flop then, was it?
Oh, not at all. I mean, a few years later when she appears on Fantasy Football League, it was a flop. But
oh, yeah, same here. That was very much a going off the rails period for her, wasn't it? If it's ever ended.
Isn't she still mental now?
Yeah, well, she appeared in Creed 2, didn't she? But noticeably, her and Sly weren't in the same scenes. I've noticed with this movie, there's a lot of sort of lines I've almost inadvertently quoted all my life. You know, obviously, get that F out of here when he shouts, "How you doing? How you doing?" enthusiastically to one of the characters. I say that to people a lot.
Do you do it in exactly the same way as Eddie Murphy?
No.
I mean, one thing I will say about Eddie Murphy through all of his career, the 80s were, you know, the high points. And then by the time the 90s came around, I start seeing him in things like Flubber. Probably around Harlem Nights, his career starts to go downhill.
To be honest, after Harlem Nights, I don't think I've seen the Nutty Professor movie once, but for some reason in my teens then, I decided to totally avoid all his movies. Like, I think, was that one, The Vampire in Brooklyn and Flubber?
I never saw Flubber. Don't think I've seen The Nutty Professor. Yeah. I have seen Vampire in Brooklyn. But he's always brought the same amount of energy to each role that he's been in.
But then one of the best things he did was receiving an award, wasn't it? And he was taking the mick out of Bill Cosby about 5 or 6 years ago, saying, you know you messed up, Bill, when they asked you to give your trophies back. And, you know, that was just like 2 minutes, and it was like, please, it was almost like a tease of, please give us more stand-up, Eddie.
There was talk for a long time about him coming back and doing a stand-up show. Even when he did Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, he talked about, I think that's the only one I've ever seen. He talked about coming back to doing stand-up, but would his stand-up stand up anymore?
Yeah, you know, they'd be the threat of cancellation, wouldn't they, I expect, with some of it?
I hope that is coming to an end now, the whole idea of cancelling. Whatever happened to redemption? Whatever happened to people making up for their mistakes?
The nature of the world going so tribal now.
However, though, with Louis C.K., winning a Grammy for Best Comedy Album.
Can I just head back to the plot of this for a minute? Something that always seemed to get mentioned in these types of 80s movies, including Die Hard, was bearer bonds. Have you ever understood what they were?
I did understand what they were, yes.
I did some research. They were a debt security, which were usually issued by a business or business entity. But apparently it wouldn't really matter if they got stolen because banks would give them to specific holders to charge for an investment. People managed to lose them all the time, and people, all they had to do was keep a record of the serial number. So I don't know how that would wipe out the plot to this and Die Hard and probably a few other movies.
I think if you looked at the plots for most films, that's what people do these days, is just look at the plots for films and how much they just wouldn't stand up.
It's been suggested this was probably one of the first, certainly 80s movie, with the sort of wisecracking lead man, and that sort of what might have brought us towards Die Hard and Arnie the following year in Commando and then Predator.
I would say it would start with something like Shaft. Shaft had a lot of wisecracks in it.
Back then, yeah, 71. Good point, yeah. Did you watch the Netflix one?
I love Samuel Jackson.
I loved the 2001. I went to see that like 3 times in the cinema when I was in Australia. I loved it so much.
Because I loved the original so much, I struggled to watch it again. It was a great film, it was very entertaining, but it wasn't the original for me.
Yeah, certain scenes sort of ingrained in my brain from this one. The blagging scene where Eddie gets to stay at the posh Beverly Hills Hotel.
Did you always want to try something like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
But never had the bottle to do it?
I potentially, you know, might at some point when I could afford to stay in a half-decent hotel or whatever, or any sort of hotel to try and get freebies, I might have breathed in and thought about it at the counter, but quickly had an anxiety attack of reason and bottled out of it. I remember trying to get upgraded on my flight home, actually, from Sydney to London about 20 years ago. And I said, I'll play you a guitar tune because I had this mini guitar, which I took on the flight with me. I just completely froze and played this really crap tune. And she just, like, ignored me then.
Oh, no. Oh, well, at least you got a good story out of it, if nothing more.
Yeah, just my humiliation, yeah. Yeah, we always loved the art gallery scene, as we mentioned, Bronson Pinchot. I love that little bit where he joins in the camp high-pitched voice with him. He's going like, get the fuck out of here, no!
I mean, his career seemed to be on the rise.
Yes, at this point.
And then he was on Blaming on the Bellboy, and he was in like a lot of other things. Then up until, was it 93, when True Romance came out, then his career just seemed to die. He just disappeared.
That's right, yeah, probably the last one I remember him in. Another one of my favourite movies.
You know, probably my all-time favourite movie.
Ah, so we'll have to do it at some point.
Yeah.
Cool, and I've got to mention as well the casting, one of a trio of very menacing bad guys in the 80s, along with Bond movie Octopussy and Rambo 3. It's Stephen Burkoff, who actually saw talk with John Ashton and Judge Reinhold at London Comic Con about 5 years ago. And in the flesh as well, he's just as menacing.
Stephen Burkoff, I always remember from being in A Clockwork Orange. He was one of the prison guards. Obviously, at the age of 9, I hadn't seen Clockwork Orange for two reasons. One, I was 9. And two, it wasn't available in the UK.
No, I watched it a few years ago. I think it was only around about 2000, wasn't it, when they finally allowed it for release?
Yes, I actually have an interesting story about Clockwork Orange. I was one of the few people in the UK in the 90s that owned a Laserdisc player. There was a company in England that sold import Laserdiscs, but obviously ones that were quite legal that you could get in this country. And they sent me their monthly catalogue because I spent a lot of money with them. And in that catalogue, it said A Clockwork Orange. So I instantly phoned up with my credit card details and said, I'd like to buy A Clockwork Orange, please. And they said, oh, sorry, that was a misprint. We haven't got it. And said, well, if you haven't got it, why are you printing it in the catalogue? Because I really want to see this. The phone went silent for a bit. And the woman I was speaking to went and said, hang on one moment, I'll be right back because I've just checked your account and you're a very good customer. And then the manager of the shop came on and said, we'll sell you A Clockwork Orange, but if you say that you've bought it from us, we'll deny it. Because I still have my Laserdisc player.
And you got the, was going to say the desaturized, despecialized Star Wars now, haven't you?
Not even despecialized. There is a trailer for the release of the original Star Wars films where it actually says this is the last time they will be released. This was the last time you'd ever get the originals. So it's like, oh, cool. So they actually told you beforehand you were never going to get these films again.
Before he started messing around with them anyway. Another person in this film who disappeared off the face of the earth was Lisa Eilbacher, who plays... She just said his friend, really. It's interesting. You think in a Stallone version, she'd probably be a love interest.
Yeah.
A bit of a damsel in distress, but also a pretty strong character.
It was in quite a few 80s movies as well.
There's one that the Still Any Good podcast I listened to, they went back and did a New Zealand movie from 1988. She does with Boba Fett himself, Temuera Morrison, called Never Say Die. And it's almost like a James Bond parody done on a low budget. But it's really watchable. It hasn't aged well, but it is still watchable. And it's all on YouTube.
I always remember her because she was in a film my mother loved, which was called An Officer and Gentleman with Richard Gere.
All right, going that far back.
Because she'd been in quite a few films.
Yeah, and she was probably one of my first crushes in this.
I mean, she hasn't actually been in a movie since 1995. She was actually in, do you remember the original Spider-Man TV with Nicholas? She was in that as well.
Oh, Nicholas Hammond.
Nicholas Hammond, I couldn't think of his name.
Eddie's two cop friends starts off with a bit of antagonization. Taggart and Rosewood, Judge Reinhold and John Ashton. Saw those two alongside Burkoff at the London Comic Con I mentioned earlier. Very funny pair together. And the director actually mentions in the behind-the-scenes documentary he wanted a bit of a Laurel and Hardy type double act about them. Do you think that comes across?
They're a really good pair, and I don't think they could have asked for better other than maybe Laurel and Hardy.
And I like the way Taggart's sort of confidence grows as we go along. He's a bit sort of a bit flat-footed to start with, isn't he? And
he is a bit of a stick in the mud at the beginning.
Oh, are we talking the older one now? That's Rosewood, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, Rosewood, sorry.
But Taggart, I like how he goes from being quite mild-mannered at the beginning. Eddie sort of teases him at one point when they take over the two guys in the strip bar. It's him and Rosewood, Axel and Rosewood, that beat the guys up, and then he comes in with a badge at the end. Like, does this sort of fake, wow, I didn't know you had it in you. Do you get the impression by the end he becomes almost, he goes full Tackleberry, I'd call it, from Police Academy, because he's got all his weapons at the end. he's so proud of them.
Yeah.
He mentions in the shootout in the house when they're both sort of laying on the lawn behind the wall. He says, do you know what? This reminds me of the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, I love that.
That's scene. a great line. And did you know that house is also used in the end of Commando? Redressed?
I thought it looked familiar. It's used in something else as well, but I couldn't think what.
Yeah, a lot of fake walls put on the inside for when Eddie gets shot and you see the blood splattering on the wall. Jonathan Banks gets offed quite nicely. Perhaps not as violently as he was in Breaking Bad.
No, true.
And Burkoff gets the same treatment. And there's time for a joke at the end when they also band together and give the police chief, who's about to fire Bogomil, isn't he? They give him their version of what happened.
The false tension of whether Taggart is actually going to tell the truth, or he's going to go along with Ronnie Cox's story.
Do you think Eddie was ever better than this movie? Post this, wasn't it? The Golden Child, I went back and watched, and that really hadn't held up well. It was very boring.
I'm trying to think what else he was in. Because when you say Eddie Murphy, you just think Beverly Hills Cop, 48 Hours. It wasn't Big Mama's House. What was the other film that he was in?
Oh, Coming to America, of course.
Yeah, Coming to America, that was great. I still haven't watched the sequel. I don't really want to.
No, have you watched the Movies That Made Us episode on it? Well, the more and more I see of John Landis, I think, what a bell end. You know, obviously there was this whole issue of the Twilight Zone trial. Apparently there was a bit of a hangover on the production of Coming to America that Eddie hadn't stood up for him in the hearing. You know, he felt Eddie owed him a bit for giving him Trading Places and helping launch his career. But I don't think he can take that much credit, because Eddie had so much energy and sort of genius in a bottle about him that he was always going to be.
And not only that, I don't remember Eddie Murphy being in The Twilight Zone.
No, I think it's because, you know, The Twilight Zone happened in 82. Trading Places happened in 83, but the Twilight Zone lawsuits didn't go to trial till 86, asking for character witnesses for John Landis, and I think Eddie got asked and didn't agree to do it. Why would you, you know, if two children and an actor died on the set?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big ask for someone.
So they had a big meeting on the set of Coming to America, and Eddie said, you know, this is the last few days' work I'll do for you, after they had a big argument. And he said, I don't want to see you again. 5 years later, they got a phone call saying, Eddie, we want to do Beverly Hills Cop 3. And Eddie suggested John Landis as director, so which turned out to be an absolute turkey, but apparently they got on again by the end.
But there again, you know, how many people have fallen out? Harold Ramis and Bill Murray fell out.
Yeah.
They made up before Ramis's death. An interesting fact, before Tim Burton's Batman, there was talk of, and serious talk about doing Batman with Bill Murray as Batman and Eddie Murphy as Robin. It'd be a very strange film to see.
Not sure if it's available online, but they did a pilot for a series back in 2013 with another African-American actor whose name I can't think of, but there was a plan for Eddie to guest star in that.
I don't want to see a Beverly Hills Cop TV series. I don't want to see a Beverly Hills Cop 4, because you mentioned Cobra Kai. A lot of people love that show. I enjoyed the first two series, but by the time the third series came out, even though I was watching it at a bad time in my life, I tried watching series 4 and I just found it boring. I turned it off after about 20 minutes of the first episode.
Forgot to mention the very start of this film. I've always loved those opening titles, and the fact you see sort of rundown post-automotive industry Detroit.
Yeah, it opens up really well.
Sort of wisecrack at the beginning in the back of the truck. That was based on Harvey Keitel and is it De Niro in Mean Streets?
Yeah, I always had a memory of that scene where, you know, with the truck is driving around.
Yeah.
And you had Eddie Murphy going, fuck, 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 fuck. But I don't remember it being in that. I watched it again this morning before to prepare for this.
Like me, you probably saw it on BBC and they probably cut it out. But yeah, I had that version taped off TV for so many years. So it's like with a lot of films, isn't it? You know, if you haven't got the original version, back in the 80s, you had the watered down one. Like, luckily, I was old enough when I got the sell-through video of Die Hard. But then it turned up on ITV a few years later and it was Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer.
Nice. How would you say this holds up after nearly 40 years?
As you said, very much of its time in the 80s, but enjoyable for it. Brilliant pacing, superb breakout performances, lots of brilliant little cameos. We also get Damon Wayans, don't we, as the camp guy in the hotel. We haven't mentioned what a lot of people remembered about this film when we were growing up. Would the banana in the exhaust pipe work? Would the trick work? I think it would just decimate the banana, wouldn't it? Probably give you a very hot piece of fruit.
And probably fall out.
Yeah, blast it out, yeah.
Even as a kid, I thought, that's not going to work.
No.
Yeah, so what would you give this out of 10 then?
Oh, always a 10, just partly for nostalgia, but great pacing, fantastic soundtrack. Superb performance by Eddie. Cannot really envision it with Sylvester Stallone. Okay, it might have been a good movie, but the thought of not having this with Eddie is too much to bear. No,
And also,
I can't imagine it without him, really.
Yeah, no, I can agree with that. I'm going to go with 10 as well. There was nothing about this film that I disliked. I didn't find it boring at all, and I'll quite happily watch that again sometime soon. In fact, I've got Beverly Hills Cop 2 to watch tonight.
I mean, yeah, are we going to do that on another episode at some point to chat briefly now? Or?
No, only because I can't really remember it right now.
I tend to watch the first one a couple of times a year. I've probably seen it over 30 times, I think. It's one of those movies like Back to the Future, the trilogy. One of the first double tens we've had?
I think it's the only double ten we've ever had.
Yes, your choice next time, Lee. What are we going to go for?
Go the whole hog mog. We're going for the Welsh classic, Grand Slam.
Probably not hugely famous outside this western corner of the UK. Seen as a bit of a classic, isn't it?
Now you say that, though. I have the making of book, and there's a quote in there from Richard Burton's brother who said, anytime Richard was down and missed home, he would always put Grand Slam on to watch.
Awesome. So did he have like his own VHS copy then? Because he died in 84, didn't he? And that was still the early years of home recordings. Did he have a 60mm projection print, maybe?
You say that, though. This year is the 40th anniversary of Laserdiscs.
Wow. 82. Wow.
Yeah. So the likelihood is he had his own VHS copy of it.
Of course, yeah. And video recording equipment was around from
in the 60s. So, yeah, I mean, he would definitely have had the money to afford his own video recorder.
So next time we shall be here, there, everywhere. So beware. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, mate. Slide.